When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. I'm so pleased to have Peter Cousins as my guest today. He is an international award-winning author or editor of 18 books on the American Civil War and the American West. He retired after a 30-year career as a Foreign Service Officer, U.S. Department of State, and prior to joining the Foreign Service, he served as a captain in the U.S. Army. He is here to talk about his most recent book called A Brutal Reckoning, Andrew Jackson, the Creek Indians, and the Epic War for the American South. Thank you for coming on the show. So great to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Yes, certainly. So what was your motivation for writing this book? Why do you think the story was so important to tell?
Well, I started, loosely speaking, my trilogy on America's westward expansion with my book, The Earth is Weeping, The Epic Story of the Indian Wars for the American West. And that covers the Indian Wars that occurred after the Civil War, the Indian Wars of popular imagination. And once I completed that, I realized that by the time the conflict had reached the American West, the outcome was pretty much a fait accompli, and that the war, so to speak, against the American Indians and the usurpation of their lands, that issue was really decided much earlier east of the Mississippi River, specifically in the modern day Midwest, which was then called the Old Northwest, and to an even greater extent in the Deep South. So that led me to do a book on Chief Tecumseh and his brother and their alliance against Americans in the Midwest, and then to conclude the trilogy, where I actually should have began it, with the Creek War in the American South, which, as I discovered in the course of researching and writing the book, was really the most consequential conflict between the United States and Native Americans in our history. So to give you a shorter answer, I wrote the book because I considered the Creek War, its antecedents, and then what followed it to be the most important struggle between American Indians and the United States in our nation's history.
And there is some overlap between this book and your book about
a great deal,
Tecumseh.
You're right. And they occur more or less concurrently in time. And Tecumseh is a player insofar as helping to spark the conflict that eventually became the Creek War.
Yeah. So I would like to ask you about your decision in writing this book to use the term Indian and not Native American. Why did you make that decision?
Right. Well, you know, I took my cue from several sources, one being from American Indians themselves. They prefer, generally speaking, to be addressed by their tribal name. And then secondly, by American Indian. And Native American really has fallen out of whatever favor it may have once had among American Indians, generally speaking. You have to look no further than the National Museum of the American Indian here in Washington, D.C. That name was given by a committee of American Indians drawn from various tribes. So, I took my cue from that. And also because I think using more modern terminology, you know, like Native American, is kind of jarring and discordant in a work of history. It strikes me as anachronistic. And I at least find it jarring. And I assume many readers would as well.
Your book opens with Andrew Jackson lying on a couch in a place called the Nashville Inn in Tennessee, and in pretty bad shape. Can you describe the scene for us and tell us why you decided to use this story in your prologue?
Certainly. I decided to use it in the prologue, and I'll describe the scene in a more fully in a moment, because Andrew Jackson was, as readers will discover, he was really I think more than in any other American conflict, it was the case in the Creek War that a single man, in this case, Andrew Jackson, was responsible for the outcome. It was he alone who really had the wherewithal to prosecute the war to its conclusion after other states and territories that were involved fell by the wayside. And but the nature of the story is such that, you know, obviously I wanted to give the readers a good feel for Creek culture, a good background, not only into the Creeks, but also into the other tribes of the Deep South, give them the milieu historically and, the backdrop to the Creek War proper before I introduce Andrew Jackson. And that being the case, Andrew Jackson doesn't appear on stage until almost between, I don't know, 30% and 40% of the way through the book. From then on, he dominates the story. But I wanted to, to just inform readers early on that, hey, here's Andrew Jackson. He's going to be important. Be patient. We'll get to him in due course. And the particular scene I chose, it was ironic. Andrew Jackson was among other things, a hothead and given to duels. And he had been the second to an opponent in a duel of his leading, most important subordinate's brother. That is to say, a fellow named Jesse Benton, whose brother Thomas Hart Benton would go on to become a famous senator from Missouri, had gone to Washington, D.C. to try to get Jackson reimbursed for some extensive expenses he had incurred on behalf of his Tennessee volunteers in the early days of the War of 1812. And Thomas Hart Benton returned to find that Jackson had been a second to his brother Jesse's opponent in a duel that had left Jesse with a bullet crease across his buttocks and made him the laughingstock of Nashville. And Thomas Hart Benton was, furious because he had succeeded in Washington in arguing Jackson's case, only to find Jackson had sort of betrayed him. And Jackson's response was, "Well, I'll teach those Bentons a lesson or two." And he rode into Nashville with a couple of friends, intending to whip the Bentons. And instead, he fell into a kind of a serio comical gunfight on the steps of an inn in Nashville, in which he was the only one seriously wounded. And in fact, he was grievously wounded in the shoulder and the arm, and he almost bled to death at the very time that a courier was on the road to Nashville from the Mississippi Territory to inform Tennesseans that war had broken out with the Creek Indians after a massacre at a frontier post called Fort Mims, in which a large number of civilians were massacred. So his timing couldn't have been worse. And it was kind of ironic that Jackson, who was one of the greatest advocates of war against the hostile faction of the Creeks, found himself grievously wounded on a bed in a fight that never needed to happen.
Right. Could you talk about the clan structure, the multilineal clan structure of the Creek people?
Right. Just to open it more broadly, the Creeks were one of four tribes that controlled the majority of what is today the Deep South. You had the Cherokee, the Creeks, the Choctaw, and the Chickasaw. The Creeks were the largest of the four tribes and controlled the most land. In 1813, when the action of the Creek War really begins, you know, in earnest, the Creeks controlled all of Alabama, all of modern Alabama, the western third of modern Georgia. They numbered about 20 to 25,000 tribesmen. So it was a huge swath of land that they occupied. I mean, it included the famous Black Belt, the best soil for cotton growing in the South. And the Creeks were not a particularly cohesive tribe. They were more properly a loosely united confederacy of largely autonomous villages that, as you say, were matrilineal. They traced descent through the mother and came together seldom as a nation. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt described the Creek Confederacy very adroitly as a rope of sand, which is very much what it was. And because of the matrilineal nature of Creek society, there were a disproportionate number of Creek leaders, both in the hostile faction, the Red Sticks, who ended up fighting the United States, and those Creeks who sided with the United States, who were of Scots-Irish descent, whose fathers or grandfathers were Scots-Irish traders and merchants who intermarried with Creek women. And that can be kind of jarring to a reader to discover American Indian leaders with names like Josiah Francis and William Weatherford and William McIntosh and so forth.
So that becomes an issue later on, right? One of the difficulties for the Creek is that when they were faced with an enemy, a large enemy, they had a hard time coordinating with each other, right? Because of the autonomous nature of their tribes.
That's absolutely correct. And they were so spread out that you had this dichotomy that had developed over time between what were called the Upper Creeks and the Lower Creeks. And their villages were sufficiently removed from one another that you had the Upper Creeks, who lived more distant from encroaching whites, wanted to preserve the old way of life and resisted attempted white inroads much more than the Lower Creek villages, who lived closer to white settlers and began assimilating. And so not only could they not unite as a people, but they split into two factions that by 1813 were greatly different in their attitudes toward the United States and their ways of life.
Were they inadaptable people? I mean, they had to navigate, right, the influx of the British, the French, the Spanish, and oftentimes had to play one against the other just to survive.
They were an adaptable people, as were all the tribes of the South to varying degrees. But that adaptability and ability to play, you know, one power off against one another, of course, that ended with the American victory in the Revolutionary War. And still, you know, the Creeks, a large portion of the Creek population, especially among the Lower Creeks, were what were called Métis, or mixed blood. You know, Scots-Irish blood mixed with Creek. And they in particular adapted not only clothing and weaponry and utensils and whatnot of whites, but also took up to a limited degree slavery, cotton agriculture and things like that. And they were adaptable to a point, but when it became apparent that the United States wanted to cut a major road right through the heart of the Creek country, wanted to use the rivers that ran north and south through Alabama for commercial traffic, and wanted to impose a strictly agricultural way of life on the Creeks and try to strengthen them as a nation and dispense with a lot of the village autonomy, which was so central to the Creek way of life. That's when a lot of the Creeks said, enough is enough, and rebelled.
And you do write in your book that prior to Jefferson becoming president, Washington, Adams were passive or neutral when it came to tribes in that area. But it was Jefferson who, as president, became much more aggressive in his pursuit of Indian land east of the Mississippi River.
Absolutely. Really, the pressure didn't start building for that land until, the turn of the 19th century, until it was the start of Jefferson's administration. And Thomas Jefferson, unlike Adams and Washington, he was a proponent, an advocate of what he called an empire of liberty founded on a country that was populated largely by small farmers, as opposed to, a strong central government and a strong urban presence. And so he saw the acquisition of lands in the West, which in that time would be, the Deep South, as being critical to maintaining democracy, to allow for kind of a fast-growing population east of the Appalachians to sort of be able to acquire new land before the pressures became too great along the eastern seaboard. And also until the Louisiana Purchase, he also saw that as a way of defending the American frontier. So he advocated, he didn't want outright war if he could avoid it, but he advocated both in the old Northwest and the American South, the purchasing of as much Indian land as possible, and in the misguided belief that the Indians would willingly trade away land when they saw the benefits of becoming more like Americans in terms of their way of life, that is to say, becoming small farmers. Even Jefferson realized that might not be a realistic goal, and that eventually the Indians of the American South would have to be relocated west of the Mississippi.
So in the second war between England and America, the War of 1812, this man that you mentioned earlier and who you've devoted a book to, Tecumseh, he makes a visit to the Creeks. Would you tell us more about Tecumseh, why he visits them, what his message is, and whether or not they are receptive to him?
Right. Tecumseh was in many ways the greatest American Indian political and military leader in our nation's history. And at the time in which he speaks, he and his brother, Tengswatawa, also known as the Shawnee Prophet, led a large political, military, and social, cultural alliance in the Midwest, allied with the British against the United States, which had already made tremendous inroads. Unlike in the South, Deep South, the United States had already gobbled up a large portion of American Indian land in the Midwest, and Tecumseh was on the verge of making, as he's recognized, a last stand against the Americans in alliance with the British. And in anticipation of that, he traveled to visit the tribes of the Deep South in late 1811, calling on them to join together with his Northern Indian Confederacy to oppose white encroachment, that they you know, should not provoke conflict, but that they should all join together to resist any further attempts of the United States to encroach on Indian lands. That was the only way that they could survive. And he also planted the seed of a seed of cultural renewal and Indian social renewal among among his Creek audiences. For the most part, he was rejected roundly by the other three tribes and also by most Creeks. But he came at a time when there was already among many of the upper Creeks a movement, a kind of a radical movement brewing to do just what Tecumseh suggested, and to combine that with a cultural renewal and a push to return to the old way of life. And so he kind of nurtured a seed that was already there among one faction of the Creeks, and that faction ended up becoming the Red Sticks, who opposed first the accommodationist Creeks and then made war on the United States.
How did they get the name Red Sticks?
The name Red Sticks comes from a very effective traditional weapon that all Creeks wielded. It was a war club painted red that was used in close combat. And when you were hit with a war club, with a red stick, as they called them, it was like being hit over the head with a baseball bat. I mean, they were very effective weapons. And they had a lot of religious symbolism as well. So the traditionalist faction, we'll call them, adopted the red stick as their emblem of war. And they called themselves the Red Sticks and became known to their American enemies as the Red Sticks as well.
While we're on the subject of names, how did the Creeks get that name? I mean, it's an English name.
Right. Yeah, they call themselves the Muscogees, although many of them did adopt for themselves, especially the Métis among them, and the Literate Creeks did adopt the name Creek when referring to themselves. And that name came from back in the 1600s, when the first British traders coming from the Carolina colonies and the New Georgia colony first met these natives, and they were living alongside of Creeks in what is today Georgia. And so the British gave them the name Creek Indians, and the name took.
We will be back after this brief break.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. I also host the number one sleep podcast in the world called Sleep Cove, where millions drift off to meditations, hypnosis, and bedtime stories. We soon realized that listeners wanted to hear our mystery stories all in one place. So we created Mysteries at Midnight, where you can listen to all new tales every week. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes. So why don't you pick a story now? And can you guess the twist?
And we have returned. So the Red Sticks, inspired by Tecumseh, decided to take their frustrations and turn them into action.
Right.
What did they decide to do? What were their goals?
Well, the first thing they do is they make war, declare war on the accommodationist lower Creeks, the Creeks who lived in the southern portion of what is today Alabama, as well as western Georgia. So they first make war on their fellow Creeks and on them, particularly on the accommodationist Métis element among the lower Creeks, their objective being to bring all the Creeks in line and over to their dogma of, again, restoring traditional Creek way of life and resisting American either cultural or land encroachment. And that, within a matter of months, that degenerated into a war against the United States. And the way that happened was there were a number of, as when the Creek Civil War broke out, whites residing in the Mississippi Territory, western Georgia, and Tennessee saw this as both a threat to their homesteads and also as a possible opportunity to obtain Creek land as a result of this conflict. And frightened settlers in the Mississippi Territory, the portion that bordered on the Red Stick country, their militia prepared for war against the Red Sticks. And there was a skirmish in which a number of those who engaged with the Red Sticks were Métis, were Creek Métis, who lived just beyond the boundaries of the Red Stick land. And the Red Sticks sought to punish primarily them, and they attacked a place called Fort Mims, just north of Mobile, in which both white settlers and Métis had forted up, intending primarily on punishing the Métis for going against their own people. But as it turned out, they also slaughtered not only the white garrison, but also a lot of white civilians. And that led to a general war with the United States.
That was at the end of August in 1813, right? It followed something called the Battle of Burnt Corn.
Yeah, that was a skirmish that I was referring to earlier, in which a large war party that had gone to Pensacola to solicit assistance from the Spanish. Florida at that time was under Spanish control, that had gone to Pensacola to solicit aid from the Spanish, was returning to their home country and clashed with Mississippi Territory militia and their Métis allies.
So the Fort Mims massacre was basically a giant wake-up call to the U.S. government, right?
Yeah, it was the bloodiest massacre of whites and mixed blood people in the United States history. So it was quite a clarion call after that.
It was a complicated time, right? There was a lot going on in the country. The United States was waging war with England and also responding to this massacre. What did they decide to do to the Creeks?
Well, yeah, the situation as it quickly evolved is, as you said, the United States government, the James Madison administration, was busy fighting the British and not doing a very good job of it. Was actually losing fairly badly in the War of 1812, which was being fought principally in Canada and the Midwest along the eastern shore, and so they didn't really pay a lot of attention to what was happening in the Deep South, as critical as it was to the preservation of the United States, defeating the Red Sticks. The Madison administration pretty much left it to the state of Tennessee, the state of Georgia, and the small Mississippi Territory to fight the war as best they could. They just didn't have the resources or the inclination to pay a lot of attention to it, even though a Red Stick victory, particularly if the British were to join the fight on the southern coast, that would could portend a loss of all that land, of the Deep South to the United States. So it was very consequences of American defeat were very, very great potentially, but the U.S. government was too preoccupied fighting the British to give it the attention it deserved. So it largely fell to the hands of the militias and volunteers of Tennessee, Georgia, and the Mississippi Territory, with kind of loose supervision from the United States Army to fight the war against the Red Sticks.
So Andrew Jackson was rising through the military ranks at this time, correct? How was he pulled into this conflict?
Well, you had the Red Sticks who controlled the better part of Alabama. They had succeeded in driving a lot of the lower creeks out of their villages, and upper creeks who didn't want to join them retreated into the Cherokee country, and so they controlled a large swath of Alabama, and you had a number of attacks that were launched independently of one another into the Red Stick country. Had two expeditions in the course of 1813 and early 1814 that were launched in the Mississippi Territory, both of which achieved small victories but withdrew because of logistical problems. You had two invasions of the Red Stick country from Georgia, both of which had to withdraw ultimately for a lack of provisions. And you had invading forces from Tennessee. Andrew Jackson, who was actually merely a major general in the Tennessee militia, he commanded the West Tennessee militia, and by date of rank had actually overall command of all the Tennessee militia. And he would stage three separate assaults into the Red Stick country from the north. And by early 1814, it looked as though the Red Sticks would prevail because the Georgians had pretty much given up. They didn't see anything to be gained by further conflict, nor did the Mississippi Territory. And in fact, even the governor of Tennessee suggested that Andrew Jackson, after most of his troops had gone home when their enlistment ran out, to just give up the game and come back to Tennessee, which would have left the Red Sticks victorious. But Jackson perceived the larger threat of British intervention in the Gulf Coast, and on behalf of the Creek of the Red Sticks, he saw the strategic threat there, and he intended to prosecute the war to its completion once he had the troops to do so. So he alone was left as the spring of 1814 dawned, alone wanting to prosecute the war to its conclusion.
Yeah. There are other famous names in the story. Davy Crockett, Sam Houston.
Right.
Were they well known at this point in history?
No, they weren't. In fact, I have an article coming out in the next issue of American History Illustrated called David Crockett and Sam Houston's Baptism of Fire in the Creek War. It was in the Creek War that both of them, as young men, relatively young men, Crockett in his 30s, early 30s, and Sam Houston in his 20s, first saw war, first saw combat. Crockett didn't really make a name for himself. He was just a private in a Tennessee mounted infantry unit, and he went home after his short enlistment ran out. But he did see some significant action, and he left really vivid memoirs of his experiences fighting the Red Sticks. And he was pretty much horrified by the brutality of the war, brutality displayed by his fellow Tennesseans. And Sam Houston, on the other hand, was a lieutenant in a regiment of regulars that was raised in East Tennessee that eventually was given to Andrew Jackson in early 1814, and the presence of which, along with new volunteers from Tennessee, enabled him to finally take the war successfully to the Red Sticks and prevail. He was first an ensign, then a lieutenant in this regiment, and he fought at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, which was a climactic battle of the Creek War. In fact, it was the bloodiest battle from the American Indian point of view in United States history. Almost 1,000 Red Stick warriors were killed in less than a day of combat. And Sam Houston was grievously wounded at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, in fact, left for dead overnight by surgeons who saw no chance of saving him. But as we all knew, as we all know, he did survive and then go on to become the governor of Texas and the president of the Republic of Texas. So both his and Crockett's stories are pretty dramatic in the Creek War.
Yeah. Would you tell us a bit more about the Battle of Horseshoe Bend? Where is Horseshoe Bend and what brought each side there?
Horseshoe Bend is located in north central Alabama. And the Red Sticks by early 1814 they'd congregated. They were no longer on the offensive. They were, in fact, only briefly on the offensive. And they had congregated in three, kind of roughly around three strongholds. One in the western portion of the Red Stick country in western Alabama, one more centrally located, and then one more in north central Alabama around a horseshoe-shaped bend in the Tallapoosa River. And the group of Red Sticks that congregated there had built a barricade across that peninsula to defend against an attack from Tennessee, which Andrew Jackson launched with his reinforced army in March 1814. And his intention was to knock down this Red Stick barricade across this 100-acre or so bend in the Tallapoosa River, eliminate the warriors, and then go on to mop up the rest of the Red Stick country.
That was very interesting to read about that. Those fortifications built by the Red Sticks, they really took a page from European warfare.
They sure did. These log fortifications they constructed across this bend in the Tallapoosa that protected their village and really was as strong as probably, you know, the most earthworks constructed during the American Civil War. I mean, they were, as Jackson found to his great dismay, what he planned to do is he had all his dismounted forces, you know, his infantry, aligned before the barricade, and he planned to use his robust artillery, which consisted of two pop gun cannons, to knock down the barricade, to weaken it sufficiently for him to launch a frontal attack. Concurrently, he had his cavalry commander cross the Tallapoosa along with his Cherokee and Friendly Creek auxiliaries, which alone numbered close to 800 warriors, deploy on the far bank of the Tallapoosa to prevent warriors from escaping across the Tallapoosa when Andrew Jackson drove them from the barricade. But as things turned out quite differently for Jackson, his artillery failed to make a dent in the barricade, and he really didn't have a fallback plan. But his Cherokee allies on the far bank of the Tallapoosa grew impatient. They saw that the village across the river from them that the Red Stick warriors were defending was pretty much unguarded. And the Cherokees, on their own initiative, began crossing, swimming across, retrieving Red Stick canoes and ferrying their warriors back and forth across the Tallapoosa, attacking this village in the Red Stick rear, compelling the Red Sticks to detach warriors from the barricade to protect their women and children and retake the village. And this Cherokee initiative so weakened the Red Stick defenses that Jackson at last was enabled to launch a frontal attack that carried the day, which he would not have been had the Cherokees not taken the initiative themselves.
Right, right. He basically ordered his men to charge with bayonets. And it was a ferocious, brutal display of hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, which would have been a lot worse had the Cherokee not caused at least a third, maybe even half of the 1,000 or 1,200 Red Stick warriors to break away from the barricade to defend the village.
So out of the 1,000 or so Red Stick warriors, there were 200 or so that managed to escape, correct?
Yeah, roughly speaking, I don't recall the exact number off the top of my head, but very few escaped. They either were killed outright in the battlefield or mopped up by the army during the night, or in the case of maybe 200 or 300, they either drowned or were killed or shot by Cherokee and Tennessee cavalry on the far bank as they tried to cross the river to flee Jackson's infantry. And so very, very few made it away alive. It was a wholesale slaughter.
There is a moment, right, during one of these battles when Jackson takes pity on a child, right? A Creek boy whose family has been killed.
Right. That was earlier in the war, after one of the first battles that he fought with the Red Sticks. His men brought to him this Indian baby whose mother had been killed. Surviving Creek women didn't want anything to do with the orphan, and he decided to send the orphan home to the Hermitage to be a playmate, younger brother for his adopted son and a second son for his wife. The child's name was Lincoya. And he actually, Jackson took him in and even had an intention of sending him to West Point as the child grew to be a teenager. But unfortunately, Lincoya, which ironically is the Muscogee word for orphan, so he never got any other name except Lincoya, orphan. So poor orphan, he died of disease, and his life was cut short. But yeah, that Jackson did have a humane side to him amidst all the carnage and bloodshed.
So after the battle, the Creek were forced to sign something called the Treaty of Fort Jackson. What did that entail?
Right after the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, Jackson continued deeper into the Red Stick country. The Red Sticks either surrendered or, in the case of a couple thousand of the surviving Red Sticks and their families, they withdrew into Spanish Florida, where they finally did receive belated assistance from the British. Again, it came about a year too late. And some of the Red Sticks would fight with the British in the days leading up to the Battle of New Orleans. But for the Treaty of Fort Jackson, negotiated in the autumn of 1814 by Andrew Jackson, in which he exceeded government orders, the U.S. government wanted only to compel the Creeks to surrender enough Red Stick land to compensate the United States government for the cost of the war and turn over the Red Stick leaders. Jackson went further. He recognized that strategic interests, as well as desire of Tennesseans for American Indian land, required that he also slice off a good portion of Lower Creek country, a friendly Creek country, resting between Spanish Florida and the Creek Nation, slice off part of it as a strategic barrier between the British and the remaining Red Sticks and the United States. So it was a pretty harsh peace that he forced upon the Red Sticks and also upon friendly Creeks who fought with him.
And just a few months after the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, Jackson fends off the British during the Battle of New Orleans.
Exactly. And people tend to think that it was the Battle of New Orleans that made Jackson's reputation, made him the great national military hero that he was, but it wasn't. It was his victory at Horseshoe Bend that projected him onto the forefront of the national scene, militarily speaking. Horseshoe Bend came at a time when the United States was losing, most battles in the War of 1812, and this victory again propelled him to fame. It won for him a major general's commission in the regular army. Heretofore, he had been merely a major general in the Tennessee militia, but the victory at Horseshoe Bend gives him that commission in the regular army and also command of the military department in the South, and that positioned him to be the commanding general of United States forces that opposed the British at the Battle of New Orleans. If he had not won the victory of Horseshoe Bend, he would have returned to Tennessee, no more than a major general of Tennessee militia. He would never have had the opportunity to fight the British at New Orleans.
Yeah, interesting. And we might all be speaking with British accents here, huh?
Well, very likely, because, again, Georgia quit the war against the Red Sticks, Mississippi Territory quit the war, and if Jackson had not pushed it through to a conclusion at Horseshoe Bend and afterwards, the Red Sticks would have retained control of Alabama. You would have had the British coming onto the scene to reinforce the Red Sticks, and quite probably for at least a generation, if not longer, the Red Sticks would have retained control of Alabama and western Georgia. And there would have been no Cotton Kingdom, and thus possibly no American Civil War, because that land would have remained in American Indian hands, at least well into the 1830s, if not beyond. So it was an incredibly consequential conflict. I mean, it made possible the cotton economy of the Deep South, which in turn, of course, in part gave rise to the American Civil War. And it was the defeat of the Red Sticks that opened the door to the Trail of Tears, because once the Red Sticks were defeated, there was no other American Indian power in the American South with sufficient strength to militarily withstand the United States. And so after the Treaty of Fort Jackson from 1814 to the Trail of Tears in the 1830s, you had this gradual chipping away of remaining Creek land in western Georgia and Alabama. And then after that, the Trail of Tears involving the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw, and the Creek, in which they were all forced to resettle in modern-day Oklahoma.
So how did Jackson's experiences in the Creek War affect his presidency? How did he treat the Creek and other Indian tribes going forward based on those experiences in the war?
I think his policy would have been the same either way. There was said by the time he became president, there was such a hue and cry from Tennessee and from Georgia and from that portion of Alabama that had become settled by whites after the Treaty of Fort Jackson and some subsequent treaties. There was such a hue and cry to just seize what remained of American Indian land in the South that Jackson was pretty much riding the tide of popular opinion in the South when he began the Trail of Tears. And if he hadn't acquiesced, you had the possibility of the state of Georgia, threatening to secede from the Union. And so he was doing nothing to protect the rights of Creeks and other American Indians who were doing their level best to assimilate by the 1830s, nothing to help protect their rights, but neither was he really ahead of popular opinion in the American South to take their lands.
Ah, interesting. So, well, again, I thank you for coming on. So you have a website. People can check you out, learn more about not only this book, but the others you've written as well.
Absolutely, and drop me emails if they have any questions, and I'm always happy to respond.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Again, I have been speaking to Peter Cousins. He is the author of A Brutal Reckoning, Andrew Jackson, The Creek Indians, and The Epic War for the American South. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.